you can see that any financial relationships, there's my disclosure page right there at the top. If I had significant financial relationships, I would not be here at 8:30 in the morning doing the presentation. right? So I was one of those smart plaintiff's attorneys. In any case, I wanted to do a couple of things. First is to thank my law student, Sanjay Day, who helped me prepare this presentation this morning. I failed to include him on the cover page, and I should have. I also want to shamelessly plug, although apparently someone came in the room and more shamelessly plugged something else while John was talking. But I don't know what that figure. It looked like a campaign brochure of some sort. In any case, for those of you who are really interested in hydraulic fracturing and the nascent but existing research that we have on the health effects, or more the potential health effects of fracking, there is a another event this afternoon, 4:30 to 6 o'clock. It's number 4379, and it's in the Renaissance Meeting Room 15. And the reason I say that is because that's where the scientists are going to be. I am not a scientist. So when I say words like benzene, it's only because a law student told me that I could say that word and get away with it. But more importantly, that if you're really interested in some of the hardcore science that we have or that is developing associated with the health impact of fracking, I recommend that you attend that particular session. I also want to point out, I did say the disclosure issue, sadly that I had to take notes for these little things anymore. Has anyone seen the movie Gasland? Yay, one,
no,
two.
But it was screened at our law school because our environmental guys know the guy that...
Oh, Josh Fox, and it's actually being screened at 6 o'clock at the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore today, so unfortunately I won't be there, but I'll be here, but to see that. But if you haven't and you're at all interested in the hydraulic fracturing, I recommend that you do so. It's available on Netflix, so it's pretty easy to get, but it's a documentary that I think... fairly portrays the human impact of hydraulic fracturing. It's not a scientific piece of material. It's a human anecdote documentary, and it's very well done. Also, that I actually realized that I used the wrong template for my PowerPoint presentation, because while I used to be with the Public Health Law Network, I'm now with the Network for Public Health Law. Do you need to take that down? Okay. So, but the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funds the Network for Public Health Law, formerly the Public Health Law Network, and I'm the director of the Eastern Region of the network, and we're housed at the University of Maryland School of Law. Megan McDonald and Carrie Lowry, two of my colleagues from the network, are here today. But we provide legal technical assistance on a variety of, really any, public health-related issue. And so what does that mean, and why is it relevant right now? That we are not the scientists, nor are we hardcore environmental lawyers. We are public health lawyers who principally work in policy development and identifying and helping to get around potential legal hurdles or solving legal problems that might exist when trying to accomplish public health policy. So that being said, as I said, I'm a public health lawyer. As I indicated, I'm not a scientist. I don't even have my MPH, which I know is blasphemy in an APHA meeting, but I don't. I was a finance major in college even. So, you know, I've come this far, and it's incredible. But nor am I an environmental lawyer. For those of you who work in environmental law know that there is, you know, extensive series of particularly federal laws regulating the environment. And if I wanted to become an environmental lawyer, I could certainly do that. The University of Maryland has a very extensive program. But I'm on that periphery. We are public health lawyers. So, of course, we're concerned and have to have some awareness of the scheme of environmental regulation. But again, I just want to put it out there. I'm not an expert on all environmental laws. So with those caveats, I will proceed with my presentation. So the Marcellus Shale as an energy source, and we're talking here about, John said, yes, wouldn't it be nice if there were safe and productive energy sources? And there is some question as to whether the natural gas that is locked deep beneath the surface of the earth in the Marcellus Shale or other shale formations throughout the country could be one of those safe, effective sources of energy for us. So this is really just some information about how much natural gas is actually underneath the surface in the Marcellus Shale. There are certain states affected particularly by the Marcellus Shale, which is a shale formation or a rock formation that we just started to be able to tap into, which is why it becomes more of a focus in recent times. But there are other states where certainly hydraulic fracturing is occurring. But these are the states where it's relatively new. And so these states are trying to come up with policy and ideas for how they can respond to this issue. So what's so special about the Marcellus? In large measure, the method that we have used to extract natural gas does not work in the Marcellus Shale. It's too deep. And so simply dropping vertical wells isn't working. And so, of course, American ingenuity, if there's some natural gas somewhere that someone could make money off of, we're going to find a way to get down there. And we did, or really smart engineer people did. And it's essentially a process, I think, the next page, yes, there's a picture. So this is the last picture, so enjoy it. Well, you can. Not the best PowerPoint presentation maker. In any case, you can see that the well drops down vertically and then goes horizontally. And so that's the difference between this new fracking that is occurring. And it is a significant difference because of the methodology that is used to extract the natural gas. So in essence, the well is dropped down, and then it, again, proceeds horizontally. And the actual fracking process employs hundreds and hundreds of gallons of what's called fracking fluid, which is water, sand, and some other stuff. And I'll say some other stuff because I'm not a scientist, but because we don't know what some other stuff is, because for a variety of reasons under federal law, we are not entitled to know what the some other stuff is. So, of course, reverse engineering, there are scientists working now to try to find out what is in that fracking fluid that is inserted into the well. But for the moment, let's just accept that there are lots of chemicals mixed up with sand and water. And it is at a very high velocity forced into the well, which causes little shakes in the rock, and the gas that's stuck in the rock, it's like little mini earthquakes underneath, and the gas shakes out and comes up to the surface. That was the lawyer's explanation of how this works. If anyone else can explain it better than that, feel free to do so. But that's essentially what the fracking process is. So we can get this natural gas from deep beneath the surface in the Marcellus Shale. So some of the benefits, because they don't want to be accused of not acknowledging why we're spending the time, energy, and effort to get the natural gas out as we have. Some, of course, believe that natural gas is the cleanest or one of the cleaner burning fuels that exist. And with, as you can see here, half the carbon of coal and about a third less than oil. I think there's little question that natural gas is a cleaner burning fuel. Maybe we should reduce our fuel consumption, but that's just an editorial comment on my part. So we may have reduced energy costs associated with the production of natural gas through hydrofracturing. Of course, the favorite line of BP, et cetera, is that we will reduce our reliance on foreign fuel. Let's just face facts. We'd have to produce way more natural gas than we could possibly ever produce to reduce our reliance on foreign energy sources. Potential job creation for the local and stimulation of the local economy where the fracking is actually occurring. Cornell just put out last month, earlier this month, and I have not had time to fully digest it, but a report on the potential economic impact of fracking. And they make no conclusions. They talk about some of the issues, but it looks like it's not the big financial boon that we might have thought that it could possibly be. And then the other financial issue is really for the landowner who is able to lease his or her mineral rights to BP, or I keep saying BP because they have the natural gas commercials on television. I don't know if you've seen them, and they're a direct response to some concerns about hydraulic fracturing, and because John was talking about BP, so let's just pick on the big oil company today. In any case, they're essentially going around the country, and where they believe, particularly for the Marcellus Shale, there are lucrative operations to take place, they're leasing the mineral rights from landowners. These land arts are typically in rural areas. For example, in Maryland, it's in western Maryland, which is maybe only 3 hours from here, but it's a completely different world when you get there, rolling fields, farmlands, very rural community. Unfortunately, also, for the large part, very poor communities. Garrett County, Allegheny County, Maryland, our westernmost counties, suffer from a lot of the social justice issues associated with lack of access to health care and the like that come with severe loss of jobs and the impact on the economy and public health. So you're talking about lots of money, or what actually seems like lots of money, being spread around in communities that are in great need. And so it's a very attractive option for a landowner who gets the glossy brochures about how little effect this is going to have on their daily life to lease their mineral rights. And so, unfortunately, then they become contractually obligated to allow certain activity on their property and have probably waived many of their tort rights that they might have had, based on the conduct that's occurring on their property. At the same time, communities might have infighting associated with this, where some neighbors want to allow the hydrofracturing and some neighbors don't. If your neighbor allows hydrofracturing on his property that's adjacent to yours, of course, all the concerns that you might have had related to the health and the environment associated with fracking are still present, and so you might as well get the money at the same time. So we're seeing in communities, even where there are people who are opposed, that ultimately they too may accept the lease payments under these conditions. And I just want to commend the Maryland Attorney General actually has some consumer protection oriented materials that help walk consumers through the process of executing a lease like this, what they should be looking for in these contracts. Because if it's going to be happening, let's at least, it's not going to be an arm's length transaction between rural farm owner who really needs money and BP, but if we can provide them with some consumer education, we can at least get it closer to that level. So the bad news is there's lots of potential risks associated with hydrofracturing. In some respects, no different than any other type of natural resource extraction that occurs, but in part, we are here looking at an unknown experience. So this is a new way to extract the natural gas, and we just don't know some of the outcomes, but we know enough now to address some of the more serious concerns. So the water usage. I don't know where everyone is from, but in Maryland in the last several years, we've experienced a significant amount of drought, right? It didn't seem like it over the last 6 months, because I think we had more rain in the last 6 months than in the preceding 6 years. But we've had, summers where we weren't allowed to wash our cars or water our lawns and the like because of serious drought conditions. And of course, if communities are suffering from drought and it's taking millions of gallons of water to operate a well site for hydrofracturing, where is that water coming from? It may be coming from the community, and so it's contributing to drought conditions or creating drought conditions. The other is that it may be being brought from another community that will now suffer, or you have the, which will come in later slides, what it means to bring millions of gallons of water, how many truck trips there have to be to bring millions of gallons of water to a site. So obviously, that use of the limited natural resource of water, which we don't think of as limited, but it is, certainly has an impact on the community. The toxic chemicals and radioactive materials, as I indicated, we know some about the chemicals that are in the fracking fluid, what we call fracking fluid, and that's the fluid that goes into the well to start the fracking process. What comes out is called flowback, and we'll talk about that in a second. Actually, this is the flowback slide. So the flowback, after we shoot the material into the well, some of the water will naturally come back out. Not all of it. Query, where does the not all of it go? Where does the rest of it that we don't recapture go? Well, it goes into the ground. And maybe it's deep enough beneath the surface that it's not getting into the water table, it's not getting into surface waters, but there's some indication, particularly in communities with wells, and most rural communities, of course, have wells, that the flowback material may be getting into the human water supply. So these are the types of, I can say, volatile organic compounds. I could get that out and hazardous air pollutants. Obviously, I can't even get that one out. Hazardous air pollutants, or VOCs and HAPs, for those of you who talk this language, we know are in the fracking fluid flow back. So there are a couple of issues when this water is coming back out. First, we said, where does some of it go? We don't know. That which does come back out, what do we do with it? For the most part, it sits for some period of time in probably a poorly lined reservoir. Yes, thank you. Basin reservoir that has been created for this purpose. And ultimately, it might be trucked away, that which didn't seep into the land while it was waiting in the poorly lined reservoir. So it'll be trucked away potentially to a wastewater treatment plant. Right? The problem is that there is no known method for treating fracking flowback fluid so that it can be returned back in to the waterways. So one of the issues of concern here is, what do we do with this flowback fluid? What impact is it having on the environment and therefore on human health? I think the PowerPoints will be available on the APHA site or something. If not, you can always just email me. But if you click on that little button, it'll take you to that blue line. It'll take you to the article that's in the New York Times that really revealed some of the significant concerns associated with this flowback fluid. In addition to the water, we have air issues, air contamination. When that gas is coming back up through the well, they hope to capture most of it, right, into the well. But it's gas. You can smell it. You can taste it if you live in an area where there's lots of fracking going on. You can kind of taste it in there. You can feel it in your eyes. But you can't see it. You can't touch it and grab it. We know. Even the oil and gas industry has to accept. They know that some of the gas will escape. It's part of the fracking fluid, and it comes back out and isn't able to be captured in the well. What happens with that gas that comes back out? Well, some of it is what's called vented, so it's just released into the environment, or flared, and that's essentially burning it. I don't know which one's safer. Any guesses? Anyone? Which would you prefer happened in your community, that the gas just be released into the air, or that it be burned? I'm not sure. And if you watch Gasland, you're equally not sure. So, but the EPA has expressed some concerns about both of these methods. Of course, there are concerns, as with any type of ultra-hazardous operation, which we would borrow from tort law, that any breaks in the line, any problem with this process, and we can have gas escaping into the air or into the environment from other ways. And to be sure, these are, you know, operations that are being run by human beings, and there are going to be mistakes that can occur. One thing that I think a lot of people haven't really thought about, and communities need to be aware of when they're deciding how to respond to a request for fracking to be done, is the roads and the truck traffic. So as I indicated, most of this is occurring in rural communities. It might be fun to drive on rural roads if you're someone like me and has a need for speed. I mean, I love driving, as long as it's not a little country road. But we're basically talking about two-lane roads, right? One in either direction, very little shoulder, designed to carry a certain amount of traffic, and typically designed to carry the amount of traffic necessary for the residents to come and go in that community, and potentially for any tourism that might occur. These roads are not designed to carry the truck traffic that's occurring here. What is the impact of that? Of course, the roads will deteriorate at a faster rate. But also then, the roads weren't designed with sound environmental principles of concern. So where is the runoff going? There's more significant runoff. There's more rubber burn that's going into the environment as well. So it's not just the deterioration of the road, it's the impact on the environment of all of that increased traffic. Of course, there's the exhaust from the cars as well, but that would occur. But you can see the significant number of trips it takes to bring all of the water, all of the fracking fluid, all of the equipment that's needed to set up and operate the well. It's pretty significant. It also can cause traffic problems in a community that's probably not used to having traffic problems. I mean, if you live in D.C. or Baltimore, you're like, traffic problems? Who doesn't have traffic problems? But these people don't have traffic problems. Also, noise and other issues associated with the high volume of traffic or truck traffic in these communities. And so that has become, from the human interest perspective here, the neighbors who are complaining that they didn't allow the fracking on their property, but they can't escape the impact because of the other people in the community that have allowed it. Obviously, as with anything, where we're having commercial operations on what is typically very pristine rural land, we have aesthetic issues. So when the well pad has to be created, where they can drop actually several wells from one well pad, sometimes it's cutting off a hilltop, but it's not as bad as it looks in some other industry when they have to cut off mountaintops and the like. But there does have to be a significant area of land that is cleared of trees and grass and the like, and then becomes generally an impervious surface, which presents issues on a continuing basis. But obviously the deforestation of the land creates significant environmental concerns. Occupational risks, again, not something that we tend to think about in environmental law necessarily sometimes in public health law. But, and this is typical of the oil and gas industry generally speaking, but the extraction here is risky. That there are increased, higher rates of fatality associated with extraction than with other industry operations. So there's a group of people that are actually trying to focus on gaining data, access to information about this from the public health perspective, so we can see, again, if we're measuring the benefits of getting this natural gas, let's look at the full picture of the negative health consequences, public health consequences, and occupational risk is certainly one of them. Again, noise, so not just from the trucks that are coming and going, that certainly contributes to the operation of a well. And if you watch Gasland, you can see, and some of the parts of the documentary, you can see the wells. He can never really get that close to the wells because of obviously some legal concerns. But if it's in your backyard operating, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the noise can actually have an impact on your health. And there are people suffering from chronic headaches and the like. That's probably also associated perhaps with their exposure to some of the chemicals from the fracking process. But even just the noise can destroy the harmony of a community and have an impact on public health. So you can see, and essentially the last line here is why it's important for this message to get out to the communities where fracking is, or the oil and gas industry is coming in to try to do fracking. Communities are not aware of these issues. And then once they sign the lease agreements, they are typically waiving all of their rights to take any tort or other action that they may have in these circumstances. Seismic activity. How many of you are from Maryland or D.C.? We had an earthquake. It was pretty scary, actually, for those of us who aren't used to it. If you're from the West Coast or elsewhere where you experience those things, you probably made fun of us all day, I imagine. But it was pretty freaky and scary, and we didn't know how to respond to it. But there is some concern about potential seismic activity associated with fracturing, meaning the process. If you think about what's happening, we're going very deep into the Earth's surface, down and over, shooting a hole, at very high velocity, chemicals and sand, in order to shake the rock a bit to loosen up that gas. It doesn't take a scientist actually to think that might contribute to seismic activity in a region. And to be sure, in Arkansas in particular, there were a lot of concerns associated with this. Just little small seismic activity, but that can be a precursor to a more significant event, or actually can prevent a significant event, so it can go either way. But we're occurring, and so they stopped hydraulic fracturing in the area, and the seismic activity went right back to where it had been prior to the fracking starting. And so this is another area where the scientists are starting to take a look and see, what are the consequences of that seismic activity? Are they consequences that we can accept and deal with in weighing against the benefits? There are two slides, and I'm just going to show. Vanna White style. See, there are significant federal laws regulating, obviously, for the protection of the environment. By and large, most of these do not apply to the hydrofracturing process. They may apply, but there's limitations on aggregating the harm that is being caused so that different well sites are all counted differently. And so the polluter, if you will, is not having to count all of their wells to determine whether they've reached thresholds for where they may be violating some of these federal laws. It was terribly inarticulate of me, and I apologize. But these two slides will be available, and I can find an environmental lawyer for you to answer any of your questions. The other issue is really that federal law has prevented specifically precludes mandating the disclosure of what chemicals are being used in the fracking process. And so they don't have to disclose. You know, a lot of federal environmental laws about disclosure tell us what you're doing at the very least. And there are specific provisions that exclude having to reveal what's being used in the fracking process. I will say that in a congressional hearing, I think it was last year, some of the companies brought folders and said, here, we have, you know, we're willing to share with you what's in our fracking fluid, but it wasn't made publicly available. And, if it's not required to be revealed under federal law, query whether the voluntary disclosure is accurate, if there's no consequences for it not being accurate. So that's why we might prefer for it to be accurate. So I'm a public health lawyer. Again, that's what I said in the beginning. So let's talk about the legal response to the hydrofracturing. Those states that are starting to now have the hydrofracturing occurring in their jurisdictions have adopted very different approaches or very different responses to the issue. In Pennsylvania, for example, wastewater treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants have been accepting the flowback fluid, which is actually very hard to say, and releasing it in the same way that they release any water that they were treating, and so it can get into surface water. But as I indicated before, we don't know of a method that to treat flowback fluid that we can be certain that the water when released back into the environment is safe and won't harm either the environment or its inhabitants, meaning creatures and people. So there's a concern about that, and Pennsylvania did revoke the 15 permits that they had issued to wastewater treatment plants, saying, no. We're now testing the water that you're sending back out, and there's some concerns, particularly associated with radioactive material that might be coming back into the environment. One of the big issues in hydrofracturing is the use of public lands. It's one thing for the community to decide for itself, or an individual landowner to decide for him or herself, whether the property will be used for hydrofracturing. But when we're talking about public lands, obviously it's the government that makes those decisions. So Governor Rendell, former Governor Rendell, had issued a moratorium on drilling on public lands, meaning like state parks, where people go to recreate and enjoy the environment. And that moratorium has not yet been lifted, but we expect it to be lifted, any time now. The current Governor Corbett has indicated that he will do so, maybe adopting by executive order some provisions imposing some restrictions on the drilling, but that it will likely occur on public lands in Pennsylvania in the near future. Governor Rendell had actually been, in many respects, protective of the environment, whereas Governor Corbett has seen this as an economic development effort, and so as a consequence, he has also indicated that he will veto any legislation imposing a tax on the extraction. That's one of the critical ways that that a government can actually at least secure funds that they could reserve for responding to a crisis like a BP oil spill or the like, that you have a tax and the tax goes into a fund that is designed to help remediate any harm to the community. And Governor Corbett has indicated he won't sign he'll veto any legislation that includes that tax. There may be regulatory fees associated with the initial dropping of a well. He's indicated he's interested in that. So, but one of the ways that we can protect, and I actually had no idea that we'd have some, commonalities in our presentations, but one of the ways, if we're going to allow an activity that we think may have some benefit to the community, but there is some risk, one of the, mechanisms that we can put in place is a fund to help ameliorate any of the damage that occurs either during the process or after the process when they're done the fracking process, coming through, cleaning up the land, restoring it back to its pristine appearance. And so you could use a tax in that manner. And it's not an uncommon approach. Ohio had a very similar circumstance where wastewater treatment plants had been issued or permits had been issued to treat the fracking fluid and by the Ohio EPA. And then all of a sudden the Ohio EPA said, you know, we don't even have the power to issue those permits. It is the Department of Natural Resources that has the power to issue those permits. And the Department of Natural Resources said, what permits? What are you talking about? And so that's actually the status of the law right now in Ohio. So there were permits issued. The EPA, the state EPA is now saying we didn't have the power to issue those. And the Department of Natural Resources is trying to figure out what they're supposed to do. Obviously, it's two executive agencies. It's still the state's responsibility, ultimately, but we'll see how that ends up getting resolved. But also, with respect to public lands in Ohio, the current budget pending in Ohio does presume that the state will be allowing drilling on state property and grants broad authority for the allowance of fracking on state property. In New York, the Department of Environmental Conservation is accepting comments on its health impact statement. So they're actually soliciting information from the community, from public health lawyers, from environmentalists, from scientists about the potential health impact both on the environment and on human health, which are obviously intimately connected. And so that comment period is open until December 12th, so anyone who's interested. The comments will all be made public after that as well, so you'll be able to tap into those resources and see what comments were made. But nothing will occur in New York until the regulatory process has been completed. So there are no permits issued at this time, and so there is no hydrofracturing going on in New York. I will say that Governor Cuomo has indicated more of a willingness to permit, although he can, says highly regulated, but to permit hydrofracturing in New York. And so I think if anyone's interested in submitting comments, it's probably important to do so at this time. In Maryland, we had failed legislation to issue or to impose a moratorium a couple of years to wait and see, to adopt what we call the precautionary principle in public health, right? We have reason to believe that there is potential harm to human health and to the environment from this process. We also have reason to believe there could be some benefits. We're not in a position to weigh those accurately at this time. Let's give ourselves a period of time to get there. I consider it, as a lawyer, like going in for an ex parte or a preliminary injunction, right, saying, wait, we just don't know yet. And if we allow it to happen, the damage has occurred. And so can you just hold off? And so that was the moratorium approach in Maryland. It actually failed at the legislature. And there was some belief that the Western Maryland contingent, where the fracking would occur, should be the ones to really decide this and not the full 188 members of the Maryland General Assembly. The opposition, of course, coming to this came more from the Maryland suburbs, legislators from the Maryland suburbs. So there's actually a very political battle that occurred, and so no legislation was passed. But the governor almost immediately issued an executive order imposing a moratorium. And so his agencies are not permitted to issue any permits to allow fracturing or fracking. So right now, that's the status. There is a commission that's been established. They're having public meetings. They're inviting comments and the like. And they have a series of three reports that will be due. And after that, the governor can and will reconsider the executive order. The first report is due at the end of this month. I will say Maryland, it's my state, but has been really good about seeking community input, educated community input. So going out to the community, conducting the education, the consumer education that I talked about, but also bringing out experts to talk to the community about the potential impacts of hydrofracturing so that when the community is weighing in, it's an educated weighing in. And West Virginia is probably one of my favorite examples because the state was doing nothing with respect to regulating fracking, and fracking is occurring in West Virginia at rapid rates. It's occurring on private property. It's occurring on public property. But the city of Morgantown said, wait, this is going to affect our community. We have broad public health powers as a local legislative body, and we want to ban hydrofracturing from our community. And one of my big mantras is that public health should be local, and local communities should have a lot of power in deciding these sorts of issues for themselves. But unfortunately, the court overturned the city ordinance, saying that it was preempted by state law, that if state law allows the issuance of these of permits for this activity, that the local could not prohibit that activity. So this is actually in contradiction to some of the efforts around the country, and I don't catalog them here, but have been done at the local level. Some, for feel-good reasons, the city of Pittsburgh passed a ban on hydrofracturing. But if you know the city of Pittsburgh, you might imagine that there's no place to do any hydrofracturing in the city, so it was unlikely to actually occur. But it was actually an approach that was meant to give power and support to those local jurisdictions throughout Pennsylvania that wanted to do that. And so I think the city of Pittsburgh was really doing it for that reason, the solidarity for local power. It's probably also preempted by state law, but since no one wants to frack there, no one has sued them yet. So we won't know the resolution of that particular issue. So that's how the states have been responding to the issue of hydrofracturing. I mean, there's a summary here, but I think the bottom line is we don't know enough about hydrofracturing to let it occur yet. It may, in fact, be that there is a safe way to extract that natural gas, and that would be great because there are lots of benefits to the availability of that natural gas from a an energy perspective. But there are lots of concerns, and just because there's money to be made today doesn't mean it has to be made today. It can be made in the future, but in a way that protects the environment and human health. And the other issue to remember is the communities that will be directly impacted by fracking are typically communities that are particularly poor, and there are social justice issues associated with increasing the rates of illness in communities where there are already high rates of illness or occupational risks and lack of access to health care. And so we've tripled or doubled our social justice issues here. At the same time, don't think that we can sit in our suburbs or even in our urban communities and think, well, fracking's a problem that's occurring out in the country. The water that we drink probably comes from all of those same sources, and water flows. Have you ever noticed that there are rivers and streams? And that's where all of our water ultimately comes from. And so fracking that occurs in one jurisdiction that might seem quite remote to you could certainly have an impact on your drinking water as well. And just one anecdote there is there was a spill that occurred in Pennsylvania from fracking process that was occurring lawfully in Pennsylvania, but it got into the Susquehanna River, which comes into the Chesapeake Bay. And our Attorney General, Gansler, is hotly protective of the Chesapeake Bay and has filed a notice of intent to sue Susquehanna Energy, what's the name of the company, Susquehanna Energy Company or something, and threatened to sue them associated with that spill because obviously it was a lawful activity occurring in Pennsylvania. An accident occurred because they happen when human beings are operating, and the spill, of course, affected Maryland waterways. So, until we have resolution of this issue, we're going to see that sort of litigation. So, any questions? Sure.
My name is Jennifer Tiffany. I chair the Gas Drilling Task Force in Georgia Council, New York State, that has recently banned fracking, but because of the regulatory environment, you can't ban fracking for a simple.
Right.
And I guess I wanted to tie the two pieces together a bit. The rationale for the bans is frequently based on the responsibility of local municipalities to protect health and safety. And the fault lines, the litigation, the suits are going to be over whether the state has the power to preempt or whether we
right.
have the power to zone in the interest of health and safety. And one of the equity issues that we see in actually the community that is now, one of the communities that is going to court on Friday, is that approximately 40% of their land is leased. It is owned by approximately 7%. impacts on air and water quality and air and water supply in particular. So I'm guessing that, you know, for you guys who are public health lawyers, there are going to be a lot of opportunities for amicus briefs.
Yep.
You know, we're going to really need you to step in at that level to sort of backstop the local municipalities who are really working.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
I was just reminded that we're supposed, and I didn't do this for my presentation, kind of repeat
the question,
because otherwise it won't get picked. I mean, our answers will make no sense. They might not anyway, but
that'd be on us, right?
But I mean, if you could just take from that the piece
I mean, I think what we have here, and it was almost as if I invited you to come and make these comments, right? That there's a local jurisdiction in New York that is dealing with this issue.
Many jurisdictions.
And one of the creative ways of doing that, instead of issuing a ban on hydrofracturing, is to adopt zoning or other land use provisions that prevent heavy industrial operations, which would then include fracking. It will include other activity that you may want to preclude anyway, but it may be a way to avoid a preemption challenge. It won't avoid the challenge. You may have more success in that challenge on preemption because local land use regulation is very strong. That power is very strong, and it will take almost explicit effort by the state to preempt local land use regulations. But the request here is that those of us working in public health law stay attuned to what's going on, and when these local jurisdictions do get sued on preemption and other bases, that we engage in what I'll call litigation advocacy, and that is submitting amicus briefs that really get to the point of both the precautionary principle and how it should apply here, as well as the importance of local control over public health regulations. So that's a great example. Thank you.
Somehow it reminds me of the gold rush in Alaska, where some people profited and a lot of the public were left with the toxic waste and all this. And if you ever go up to Alaska, you still see that. And I'm wondering how much we learned from that and how much law may be coming out of this. I'm an occupational physician. And as such, as an example, if a worker comes to me and says, I have some exposure to something, I don't know what it is, I have the right now to ask the employer under right to know law to provide me material safety data sheets for the exposure. I figure in the environmental, and we don't have that. But I'm thinking if now people come, I have practice in Albany, New York. So if people come to me now and say, "Doc, please evaluate me for potential health effects or already health effects on my children." Can I go out and give the person something or write to whoever is drilling there and say, please, under whatever public law, provide me information with what exposure so I can do better diagnosis and treatment. Is there any
I'm going to repeat back the question, as John indicated. So first, the comment was related to it. During the gold rush in Alaska, we had some of these same issues where some made a lot and a lot suffered some as a consequence of the impact of the gold rush, and that it's still evident when one visits Alaska. And is that a lesson learned? It certainly is. It should be a lesson learned for us. I don't know enough about whether we've studied that and modeling what should happen based on the impact of that. But that's something provocative that I'll take a look into. The other is the questioner is an occupational physician, so deals with people who are suffering from health consequences from exposure at work. And some laws do allow a physician in that circumstance to request information from the employer about the employee's exposure. I will say I'm frankly not terribly familiar with I know enough about those laws to know that they exist, But the overlay of environmental laws that protect against disclosure in some instances. And so this, again, is another area where why we have to slow down and take a look at things. But it might be a great way for us to find out more about what's happening with fracking by looking at the injuries or the illnesses associated for employees who are working in the fracking context. So I think that's an area of law that we have to take a look at. And I thank you for raising it. And I actually will follow up with you. I can put one of my busy bee law students on this question to look at to see where is the overlay between occupational safety and mandatory disclosures with respect to the hydrofracturing process.
Yeah, I'm Barbara Bradley with Physicians for Social Responsibility. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I think as we look at the pluses and minuses, and especially the impact of fracking on the commons, you actually, to my way of thinking, kind of are lowballing some of the potential negative impacts. So to start with just some of the kind of conventional ones.
Can I just say, I just want to stop for one second because I'm going to have to remember everything that you're saying. So I'm going to start with the comment comes that maybe I'm lowballing some of the potential health impacts. That is absolutely true. And not necessarily intentionally, except that I don't ever want to be accused of overstating things, but I'd love for you to take the next step. So yes, please.
Well, I want to mention just a few, but I think you're really missing potentially the biggest one. So in a more conventional category, truck traffic is, you mentioned in passing exhaust, but I think we should minimize the impact of particulate matter pollution. It impacts not just the respiratory system, but also the cardiovascular and the nervous systems. You mentioned in passing radioactive materials and fracking fluid, but I don't know what they are or what their half-life is, but you know they're deadly for a very long time. You suggested that natural gas is a cleaner and probably safer alternative than petroleum products, and I agree with that, except that it's the usefulness or the application of natural gas is limited. It's not going to replace petroleum products in vehicles, for example. So although for certain purposes, yes, it's relatively better, it's not going to give us the energy and the that we want. But the one that you didn't comment on, and I would hope you would, is the contribution of fracking to climate change. Because methane, which is the primary component that we have in the venting and that may be burned, is a much more potent contributor to climate change, a much more potent greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide. And so if you consider the contribution, the potential contribution, I know not well quantified at this point, of fracking to climate change, then all of a sudden the commons becomes enormous. The affected populations become all of us. And so it seems to me that should really enter into the weighing and balancing.
Great, so I'm going to repeat back what you said. So if I actually took notes, if I would get it right. The first is that maybe underselling the impact of the exhaust of the truck traffic, that it certainly has significant impact on both respiratory and cardiovascular health in the community. And there is no questioning that's definitely the case. The concern about radioactive materials is significant. It's actually something that a lot of the focus of the scientists who are looking at the impact of fracking are looking at because of the seriousness of that exposure. We just don't know enough yet to answer some of the tough questions. Again, calling to question the real benefits of extracting all of this natural gas, and as I indicated before, yes, it's cleaner burning, but that doesn't make it, that doesn't help us with our reliance on other fuel mechanisms. And of course, while there are certainly industry that's working on developing cars that could run on natural gas right now, there are not cars driving around on our roads. So it just certainly does not replace or really cut out our reliance on these other fuel sources. And the biggest question is the impact on climate change. And you're right, I don't mention that. You may have not been in the room when I start talking, but maybe the 4:30 presentation that's being done may address some of these issues more broadly. I can say I haven't seen a lot on directly addressing the question of climate change, but I think what it is as we piece together the little pieces that we're learning about the process, so the truck traffic issues, the radioactive materials, the venting and flaring that's going on, we'll have a better idea of the impact from a climate perspective. And so I think because that's a cumulative process that contributes to climate change, that's probably what we're going to see later in the research unfortunately, because we have to get the information first to assess the climate change impact. But to be sure, there's a potential climate change impact here that makes it not just that Maryland cares that Pennsylvania is allowing fracking, but that Coloradans should care. Is that the right word for people who live in Colorado? People who live in Colorado should care about the hydrofracturing that's occurring in West Virginia, because we all feel the impacts of climate change.
I just wanted to follow up on your comment about the size of the commons, because if you look at a global map of the shale gas formations that are available, and also other formations where gas is embedded in rock, it covers a very large portion of the globe. You know, if you look at just the U.S., it covers a very large portion of the U.S. I think some of what has happened recently is that extractive industries have come to areas that are not used to just hopping to extractive industries.
Right.
And there's a very big difference between New York State and Pennsylvania in terms of the initial resistance. But I think what we have to be aware of is